your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Coplin.
Welcome to the show where we balance the intellectual with the creative, exploring whether we have more in common than divides us through thought-provoking conversations. For the topic hour, I go out and about and talk to people on the street about a wide variety of different subjects that affect us all, both locally and globally. And for this, the Arts Hour, I interview local, national and international guests from all areas of the arts. The show combines a debate topic with an arts interview because discussion and creativity, I feel, are two of the most vital ways we engage with the world. If you'd like to find out more information about the show, you can go to the website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. You can hear podcasts of all past shows there, all the interesting topics we've had and some fabulous guests, and you can connect with me on social media also, should you wish, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, etc. So again, the show website is itsaquestionofbalance.com, and on the homepage there are tabs at the top for guests and topics, which makes it easy to browse and choose the podcast you want. So do check that out. This week, I'm pleased to be interviewing Christopher Jansma, award-winning best-selling author. Christopher's first novel, The Unchangeable Spots of Leopards, published by Viking Penguin in 2013, was critically acclaimed and a success with readers. Described as F. Scott Fitzgerald meets Wes Anderson by The Village Voice, and a canny, seductive and utterly transfixing tale about the magic of storytelling and the misery of writing by Donna Seaman of Booklist, Christopher's inventive and witty debut describes a young man's quest to become a writer and the misadventures in life and love that take him around the world. The Unchangeable Spots of Leopards was an honourable mention for the Penn Hemingway Prize, a finalist for the Prix de l'Impassu, and longlisted for the Andrew Carnegie Award for Excellence in Fiction, and the Flatty Dunnan First Novel Prize. It was a Barnes & Noble Discover pick, an ABA Indie Next Choice, an ALA Notable Book, and an alternate selection for the Book of the Month Club. The novel has also been translated into German, French, Italian, Dutch, Czech, and Turkish. Growing up in Lincroft, New Jersey, Christopher received his BA in the writing seminars from John Hopkins University and an MFA in fiction from Columbia University. He has written a column for Electric Literature about literary artifacts and loving books in a digital age, and his work has also been published in the New York Times, Columbia Magazine, The Believer, Slice Magazine, The Blue Mesa Review, and On the Millions. Christopher is an assistant professor of creative writing at SUNY New Paltz College and is the winner of the 2014 Sherwood Anderson Fiction Award. Christopher's second novel, Why We Came to the City, has just come out and is described by Publishers Weekly as a tightly written, smartly conceived story that puts an insightful spin on life in the Big Apple. Welcome to the show, Christopher.
Thanks so much, Ruth. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm wondering, your life obviously is all about writing now. You're teaching writing and you're writing. I'm wondering whether you can remember the first piece of art of any kind that had an effect on you, whether it was writing or something else.
That's a great question. When I was growing up, I was a voracious reader. Books were always the one thing that my parents would sort of get for me anytime I, asked. Anything else was sort of off the table, but a book was always something that they were willing to go out and find. And I remember reading lots of books as a kid, just, sort of constantly. And then it wasn't until about seventh grade that I was in an English class, and I had this sort of wonderful teacher who really sort of, pulled me aside at one point and sort of pointed out for the first time, I guess, in my life that I realized that, somebody writes those books, that, those books didn't all just exist, when I entered the world. So, that's a job that somebody could have and that might be something I wanted to do. So, that's my first experience with that. I think for a long time I was a reader before I even really realized, sort of what a writer was.
Right. So you were saying your parents encouraged you with buying you books. Would you say you grew up in a creative environment then?
Yeah, well, my parents were both software engineers, actually, but both had, you know, sort of, you know, strong artistic sides as well. And there was, I think, something that they really wanted to see, you know, their children, you know, pursue. So, yeah, I went to a very small school when I was young where we were really encouraged to do a lot of writing and to keep these sort of daily journals every day after recess. We had to write for a few minutes about, you know, sort of what we were up to that day, I guess. And it was one of my first sort of weird experiences with fiction, understanding what fiction was, because every day I would sort of come in after recess, and for a few minutes we'd write in these notebooks about, you know, what we'd been doing that day, which in my case was, you know, playing with my friends and inventing all these, you know, magical worlds and slaying dragons and being superheroes or whatever else it was. And one day, you know, one of the teachers looked at one of these journals and sort of pulled me aside and said, you know, you're not supposed to make up these stories. You know, this isn't a time for fantasy. This is, you know, you're supposed to write about what you're really doing all day. And I had no idea what she's talking about. I said, you know, this is what I've been doing. And so we actually, you know, took our case to the principal of the school. Some other friends of mine who had also been told that they had to write about, you know, the real world. And and the principal actually took some, you know, sort of mercy on us. She agreed that she compromised that we should have a few minutes to write in our sort of normal journals. And then we should have a few minutes to write in a separate red notebook. And that could be a place where we could write all our sort of, you know, imaginary adventures. And so that became, you know, sort of very, very beginning of my life as a writer. I had to sort of go in and petition for the right to do it.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's sort of a foreshadowing of where we're moving now, sadly, in the curriculum, you know, with less and less creative writing or creative reading either. You know, it's all becoming so practical and just being able to scan, you know, nonfiction texts and things like that. But obviously, assuming you would be a big supporter of creative writing and reading.
Yeah, I do. I teach creative writing at the college level at SUNY New Paltz College, and I teach I've taught graduate courses at Sarah Lawrence College here near the city. And it's a constant struggle. And something that I really sympathize with students over. There's no way I could look a student in the face, you know, in the eye and say, this has got a lucrative career opportunities at the end of it. That would just be completely irresponsible. The reality is that, you know, our hardest working writers out there, myself included, you know, often still have, you know, day jobs or multiple day jobs trying to kind of, you know, afford to do what we do. But what I do talk to them about is, you know, if this is something that you're interested in, you know, take these classes and you can learn to get better at it and keep pursuing it. And then I also tell them, right, it really does, you know, may not have sort of tangible, you know, tangible path into a high paying career immediately upon graduation, which is of course what they're all desperately looking for. But, I tell them, you know, it's all about, you know, written communication, understanding, how to think creatively, how to understand other people, fiction, you know, the heart of fiction, I always tell them is empathy, learning to sort of put yourself in the mind and in the shoes of someone in a different situation from your own. And that's, and that's so crucial. And I think that's certainly something that would make, anyone a better version of whatever, you know, career they would be pursuing afterwards. Hopefully it's, and hopefully that does have some impact on students who go on and, you know, become CEOs or whoever, whatever else they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is one of the sad things about the arts sort of dropping out of budgets is that it does affect everything. It's not just, oh, you're doing the art to become an artist necessarily. It's just a part of being human that does cross so many other skills, I think, as you're saying.
I've seen it, I think you're right. I think it's changing, more recently. I've been teaching in different capacities on this college level for about 10 years now, and I saw a big change start to happen sort of right after the global recession in 2008. Suddenly, you know, I felt like there was a big shift. Parents were sort of driving home the importance to their kids of, you know, you must go to college, you must get a degree that you can, you know, earn a living with. And again, I don't know that they were wrong always to do that. I mean, those first few graduating classes of students, you know, faced one of the toughest job markets, you know, in recent history. So, I hope that, you know, on my end, taking a creative writing class or two is, you know, gave them a little bit of humanity to kind of, you know, help them along with that struggle. But it became, I think the emphasis started to change a little bit. And I hope that maybe as time goes on, we'll start to see that swing back a little bit.
I was going to ask you, obviously not all writers who get published have actually studied writing officially. Sure. What do you think the advantages are of actually studying writing at university as opposed to just becoming a writer?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there's certainly, you know, one of the things I love about fiction is that there's no one way to do it. You know, one of the things I tell my students in the very beginning of the semester is, you know, if anybody ever tells you, including me, that there's, you know, one way that, you know, you have to write, then, you know, you should just know right away that that's somebody that you can ignore.
Right.
You know, there's you know, a million paths to it, and everybody sort of finds their own way. You know, what I would say, you know, on the college level, there's certain, you know, sort of technical things that you have to be able to sort of get good at, in terms of, you know, crafting a sentence, you know, thinking about a complex character, you know, understanding sort of how a plot works. And so there are things that, you know, real sort of informational types of things that you can learn in a classroom easily about that. But the hard part of it is always carried on, you know, sort of independently, whether you're in a classroom or, you know, the writing that my students are doing on the more advanced level is something that they're doing on their own. I don't give them prompts. I don't give them, I give them deadlines, basically. And I tell them, you know, it's your job to be, you know, working on this, you know, sort of all along the way and thinking about what you want to write and how you want to do it. And what I'm trying to really do is train them to be prepared for what happens after they graduate and they are off in the real world and they need to carve out, you know, sometimes, you know, only a few minutes, you know, in a day or a week that you can write. And you have to be ready to do the best you can during that time, you know, whatever's available. Yeah. Even myself, you know, now I tell them this is now my second novel and I'm teaching a full-time load and I have a son, a wonderful son who I'm home with a few days a week. And so, you know, real life is always sort of intruding on writing time. And, you know, there are weeks that I'm lucky if I get, you know, an hour to sit down and really focus on writing. You have to be able to do that, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if you just joined us, I'm talking to my special guest this week, award-winning best-selling author Christopher Jansma. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland. We're going to a break now, but we'll be back after these messages. Film Festival by USA Today readers. The Cinequest Film Festival runs March 1st through 13th in San Jose. Here's Cinequest co-founder Kathleen Powell talking recently on It's a Question of Balance.
I was wondering why you chose Silicon Valley to base the festival in.
Oh my gosh. You know, Silicon Valley is such a unique place. It's where creativity and innovation come together to empower. And that's our vision with Cinequest. This is where it all happens. We want every individual that walks through the door to feel like the value that they got far exceeds what they ever put into it.
Presenting Maverick Spirit winners James Franco and Rita Moreno and 129 premiere films, Cinequest invites you to join artists, innovators and film lovers from all walks of life, March 1st through 13th. Festival passes and packages available now at cinequest.org. That's cineqest.org.
Do you you like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland? Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com. It's a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Hi, I'm Casey, and I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore and have been located in the heart of downtown Santa Cruz for over 47 years. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copeland, and my special guest this week, Christopher Jansma, award-winning best-selling author. And I wanted to let local listeners know that Christopher is going to be at Bookshop Santa Cruz on the 24th of February at 7 p.m. So you'll be able to meet him in person, get your book signed if you so wish. So that's 24th of February, 7 p.m., Bookshop Santa Cruz for local listeners. Your debut novel, The Unchangeable Spots of Leopards, was critically acclaimed, Christopher, with endless positive reviews, so a huge validation of your talent. I'm wondering how your debut novel, being such a success, affected you as a writer going forward, sort of what kind of shadow it cast or light it shone on your process for the new novel.
Thank you very much. It was a big hit. I was so relieved when I was writing it. I had no idea, of course, if anybody would ever get to see it, and I was really just trying to write something that I would I would enjoy writing, and it was great to see it sort of resonate with so many people. It's a novel that is in a way sort of about a slightly taboo subject, which is it's a novel about a novelist trying to write a novel, which I was told repeatedly at the time, it was a terrible thing to try to do, and I was really excited to find that people were lining up to read it after it came out, because I had a suspicion that there were a lot of people out there that would be interested in that, as I am. But I was also lucky, I think, that I had started working on this new book, Why We Came to the City, already before that first novel came out. I had gotten almost, I think, about halfway through the writing process on this one when that book came out, and that was really something that I'm really happy about in retrospect, because the excitement and sort of the roller coaster ride of having my first novel come out was a huge distraction in a wonderful way. But I think it would have been a lot tougher to sort of sit down right after that it all happened and try to start writing something new that would live up to, or hopefully even kind of exceed that, all that excitement. So
Yeah, that makes
sense. Instead, it was nice. I had this book sort of, you know, in the works already, and I had a solid idea about what it would look like.
Yeah, that was fortunate, I think. There's a lot of pressure from something like that when you have a big success, yeah. Your second book, Why We Came to the City, has just come out. Can you tell us a bit about the story without giving too much away?
Sure. It's a novel about five college friends that are living in New York City about, I think, 5 or 6 years after they've graduated. And they've been, you know, sort of chasing their dreams. Each of them has sort of different ambitions, but they've all sort of come to the city together to try to help each other, you know, sort of achieve that. The book begins in the winter of 2008, right as the sort of global financial crisis is starting to kind of hit in New York in particular, and moment where suddenly that sort of, you know, upward momentum that they've been feeling for the last 5 years suddenly sort of, you know, stops, they're starting to kind of grapple with, you know, what's going to happen next. For the first time, really think about sort of why they're there and what's going to happen. And then sort of along with that, one of the five in the group, a girl named Irene, who wants to be an artist, but she works as an assistant in an art gallery, discovers that she has sort of a small lump under her cheek and has just been to the doctor to get it tested to see if it's cancerous. And so the novel sort of follows this down as she becomes diagnosed with cancer, and shows really how these friends can kind of come together to try to support her during her illness, and then continues to kind of try to explore what happens, what happens to all of them afterwards.
You mentioned Irene, who's diagnosed with cancer, as you say, and sadly your own younger sister died at a very young age from cancer. I'm wondering what it felt like to draw on such a poignant and intimate experience in your own life and put it into your fiction.
Yeah, it was tricky. My younger sister Jennifer was a ballet dancer. She had been part of the Miami City Ballet and the Carolina Ballet in North Carolina for several years before she was diagnosed with cancer. Right around the same time that the book takes place in 2007, she passed away early in 2008. And it was a huge shock. You know, she was an incredibly healthy 22-year-old girl, and she was diagnosed with oral cancer, which is a, you know, kind of cancer that I was told, you know, over and over again, you know, you typically saw in, you know, much older people who've been smoking or chewing tobacco their whole lives, and there wasn't much of an explanation for how it had come about. And so it was a big sort of, you know, splash of cold water on everyone. And she came to live with my fiance, now my wife. She came to live with us in our very small New York apartment for about 5 months while she was getting treatments here in the city. The novel was sort of born out of me sort of looking back on that time thinking about, you know, sort of what it was like to, grow up very, very quickly. I was about 25 years old when that happened, and she was only 22. And we had to, you know, suddenly deal with all of that during at the same time as everything else that was going on in our lives. We had, you know, I was a young adjunct professor, I was making almost no money teaching essay writing classes, and my wife was an editorial assistant at a publishing house, and working, you know, 10 hours a day and scrambling to, you know, to kind of make ends meet all the time. And then on top of that, we have, you know, my sister on the couch, you know, having just gotten chemo. So it was a difficult experience, and it was a very hard loss when she passed. It took a little while for me to really come around to, you know, beginning to be able to write about it. I really didn't want to go for my first response to the whole thing. It was just sort of in intense anger, and couldn't see how to turn it into something, you know, I didn't want to turn it into anything that would seem like it was sort of making that whole experience worthwhile or justifying it somehow. And
yeah.
So it took a while, but what ended up happening was that I, you know, these themes and ideas started to sort of just emerge on their own as the more that I wrote, the more that those things started to pop up, questions about mortality and friendship and the end of, you know, youth and several pieces that I wrote in 2009, about a year after she passed away, started to kind of coalesce and come together into what became this book.
Mm. I mean, so it sounds like rather than trying to make sense of what happened with her and come to some sort of easy, like you said, sort of like, oh, well, it was worthwhile it because of this, that
right.
You were just really
something in the end.
Yes, you're exploring all the different emotions and thoughts that you had from the process.
Yeah, I wanted to really explore what happens when such a huge sort of disruption happens. You know, the not making sense of it all actually, I think, is a big part of the story, and that was something that I wanted to, you know, sort of I wished I'd read a book like that while I was going through it. Something that would sort of explain, you know, sort of, you know, how this could be happening and what it was going to be like, and then also trying to figure out sort of how to deal with grief and loss. And, you know, one of the things that I found out and tried to kind of include this idea in the book is that everybody sort of grieves in very different ways. And that can be, you know, sort of even more isolating, even when you have a group of people who are all really mourning the same loss. They, you know, everybody sort of, you know, approaches it in a different angle.
Yes.
And so it can become even harder to, you know, to sort of, you know, it's very hard to grieve collectively, I think.
Yes, yeah.
And that's something that the characters, you know, do start to deal with.
Mm. The human characters in the novel are compelling, but the city also is a character of sorts. What are you hoping to convey through the sort of city character?
The city, yeah, I think of the city sometimes as sort of another character in the novel. It is New York City, but I think, you know, the specific details about it make it New York City, but it could really be sort of almost, you know, a story that happens anywhere in any sort of big city where people come to sort of chase their dreams. Mm-hmm. What I wanted to capture was the way that these characters are sort of, you know, almost in a weird way, like pilgrims. They've sort of, you know, come to this larger thing, and they're trying to sort of experience it together, and just sort of hoping, you know, if they kind of have faith that it's going to work out. And so the city is, in a way, it's like a character, like a sixth friend in the group. And but at times it's also an enemy. You know, it's an obstacle. They're trying to, you know, just do something ordinary, like, you know, pick up a medication from the pharmacy, and somehow the city, you know, manages to kind of thwart them at every turn. And that's one of the things that, you know, I love about living in a big city, is that, you know, there are times when it's an ally and times when it's against you.
Yes, yeah. In Why We Came to the City, one of the characters, Jacob, states, "Real art obliterates artifice. It makes you forget that it ever had to be created in the first place. Art makes you feel things nobody ever taught you to feel before, because you're feeling what some stranger felt when he, or you'd better bet she, made it. It's living vicariously. It's the only thing on this planet that can make us leave the pathetic smallness of our insignificant speckness and not just connect but become someone else. It's got to be metamorphic." I'm wondering how much of this reflects your own feeling about art.
It's exactly how I feel about art, and art, and of course literature and music. One of the things that Jacob's railing against in that scene is one of the other characters has just taken a class in something called like Art After Warhol or something, and I think he's reacting to a certain type of kind of like ironic art that can sometimes become really popular, and that's something that I often sort of think about, you know, sort of what's the purpose of making a painting that just, you know, where it seems like the point of, you know, looking at a painting of a soup can is to remind you that this is just a painting of a soup can.
And, right, yes.
you know, and which I can see the value in that, of course. But for me, you know, I'd much rather sort of, you know, just get lost in something just truly transformative. And the works of art that, you know, have that really lasting effect on us, I think are the ones that are able to kind of reach inside you and put something in there that you don't even really understand fully where it's come from. You know, it's a feeling or an emotion or a thought.
I
believe, you know, really does come from the mind of whoever created that piece of art.
Yeah. And I mean, I was quoting this, thinking of it, of art with a capital A, you know, sort of including writing within that. And Jacob says that art, and I'll say art with a capital A, although he was talking about a small A art, mm-hmm. has to be mm-hmm. metamorphic. And this made me wonder how metamorphic you find the act of making art as opposed to consuming it.
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, I do also find it. There's something, we were talking before about some of the unfortunate parts of my life that led into writing this. So there's certainly something therapeutic about writing, and it can change you, I think, on that level, you know, sort of in a healing way. It can also, you know, one of the greatest things about writing, I think, and you know, probably true of other arts as well, is the possibility for discovery, you know, sort of learning something new about yourself as you're working on it. You stumble into something that you weren't really anticipating. For me, you know, a lot of times it's something about a character that was there maybe the whole time, but I just never quite, you know, kind of realized. And then suddenly the character is in a situation and I suddenly realize, you know, no, you know, he or she would do, you know, wouldn't do that. Actually, they would say this, you know, this is another layer to them that I wasn't aware of, or something like that. And I think that's, you know, what I like to try to, you know, that's what I'm always sort of hoping for anyway, when I'm writing each day, is to sort of stumble onto something, you know, a little bigger than my plan going into it. You know, so there's always a little bit of seeking, I think, involved in a good day of writing.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Well, if you just join me, I'm talking to my special guest this week, Christopher Jansma, award-winning best-selling author, and I wanted to let local listeners know he will be appearing on the 24th of February, 7 p.m. at Bookshop Santa Cruz. We're going to go to a break now, but we'll be back after these messages. Film Festival by USA Today readers. The Cinequest Film Festival runs March 1st through 13th in San Jose. Here's Cinequest co-founder Kathleen Powell talking recently on It's a Question of Balance.
I was wondering why you chose Silicon Valley to base the festival in.
Oh my gosh. You know, Silicon Valley is such a unique place. It's where creativity and innovation come together to empower, and that's our vision with Cinequest. This is where it all happens. We want every individual that walks through the door to feel like the value that they got far exceeds what they ever put into it.
Presenting Maverick Spirit winners James Franco and Rita Moreno and 129 premiere films, Cinequest invites you to join artists, innovators and film lovers from all walks of life, March 1st through 13th. Festival passes and packages available now at cinequest.org. That's cinequest.org.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made dessert in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Daniel and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Can you imagine living without stress, anxiety, or fear? And can you imagine a life filled with harmony and inner peace? Is that even possible? The Ananda Yoga and Meditation Center in Scotts Valley offers simple tools to help you become more effective at work and more centered in the face of life's challenges. At Ananda, we offer yoga classes for everybody, inspiring workshops, devotional chanting, and Sunday services based on the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. Our teachers and therapists are highly trained professionals who work together to inspire a healthier you. And your first Ananda yoga class is always free. Visit us at AnandaScottsValley.org or call 338-YOGA. That's AnandaScottsValley.org or 338-YOGA.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts this week, Christopher Jansma, award-winning best-selling author. And we've been talking about his new book, Why We Came to the City, which has just come out. And just to let local listeners know again, he'll be at Bookshop Santa Cruz, 24th of February at 7 p.m. So I'm wondering about your process of writing, Christopher, and author Rafe Larson, who's been a guest on the show, he talks about how the book talks to him while he's writing, and even if he might hate what it's saying, he makes himself listen. And I'm wondering if you experience that voice, and if so, where you think it comes from.
That's a great question. I love Rafe. He's such a brilliant guy. I actually knew him a little bit when we were both at Columbia, getting our MFAs around the same time.
Oh, cool.
He's a wonderful guy. So, about teaching, the book sort of speaking to us. I think that's really true. I think the book, I try to write without as much of a floor plan, I guess, as possible. My first book, actually, wrote most of it without any clear idea going into it, how the various chapters of it would fit together. I sort of wrote, 8 or 10 stories or sort of separate pieces that I spent about a year trying to kind of assemble. This book had a little bit more of a clear structure in my mind from the beginning, but a lot of the particulars, sort of what was going to happen to each of the characters along the way, I really intentionally left blank because I wanted that sense of them growing as characters throughout the book to feel just really organic. And the way that it happens in my mind, at least, is that, I help create these characters in the beginning of the book and then I kind of set them in motion. And then I try to listen to them and really think about, and kind of let them take over to some degree and figure out, what are they going to be doing in this scenario? That's something I teach my students a lot in my classes, that for me, the best writing sort of obviously has wonderful characters and wonderful plot, but sort of allows the plot to sort of derive, as naturally as possible from character. What happens next is always a question of, what would this character do or say now,
Yeah. And I mean, that sort of feeling of a book taking you along or wanting to say certain things. I mean, do you have any sense of that coming from like the kind of collective unconscious or, people talk about muse or inspiration or do you see it as a sort of internal psychic process?
Yeah, I definitely think it comes from the unconscious. I don't know how collective it is, but I think certainly collective in the sense of, what's working on my unconscious every day are, the things that I'm reading, things that I'm seeing in the world, right? A great writer has to be a great observer, and not just with our eyes, but, also with our hearts, paying attention to what other others in our lives are going through, sort of right in front of us or tangentially. And I think all of that sort of, does its work on you as a person. A lot of that plays into what's going on in your, maybe sort of sub and unconscious mind. As you're writing, one of the things that you're sort of looking for when you're writing is that feeling like it's just sort of taking over and writing itself. You know, the ideas are just coming from nowhere, and you have, you don't know quite what's going to happen next. And in reality, I think that those ideas aren't coming from nowhere. They're coming from, someplace deeper within you that you weren't aware of. It's something I think is really interesting about a great character in fiction is that they always have hidden layers, layers which are hidden from the reader, certainly, but also layers that are hidden from themselves. A great character, like a real person, should have their own unconscious. There should be things that they might do or say that surprise themselves, and that they don't really fully know where those things are coming from. And I think when you start to get to know a character, even on that level, that's when they really become, real to you as a writer, and hopefully then real to the readers.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because obviously as the writer, you are sort of omniscient, and sometimes it might be easy to make your characters like that as well,
Sure.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I've been reading Joseph Schubert's notebooks recently, and he observes that writing is closer to thinking than to speaking. And I'm wondering whether you agree, and what you feel might be conveyed through the written word that can't be through the spoken word.
That's a great quote. I love that. I do think that's true. I think one of the, this is a question that comes up a lot for me is I'm a big fan of great television, which sometimes, some writers, it was very fashionable when I was in grad school, for instance, to not even own a TV, to never watch TV. And I, of course, loved it and was always watching, but I try to watch, good TV, of course. But one of the big differences then, one of the questions I ask myself a lot then is, what's the difference? What is it that fiction can do that TV or a movie, any other kind of visual storytelling, really can't, or at least can't do nearly as easily? And for me, it's all about thought. It's all about being able to get into the mind of the character. When you're watching something on your TV or on a big screen, you're always at some remove from the character. There's always, you're always in a third person relationship with them. But with a novel, whether or not it's told in the first person or the third person, a good novelist can bring you right into their thoughts. And that's a really delicate maneuver, but it's something that when it works well, you get to know these characters on a level that no one else could. We're seeing exactly what's going on in their heads in this sort of real stream moment, and that was something I really tried to do with this book. My first book was a first person story, so it was all narrated by the person telling the story, who's a little unreliable, and we get to see his sort of thoughts all throughout, some of which are not honest. And with this book, it's in the third person, but it moves, kind of fluidly from one section to the next, from one character to the other. And hopefully one of the joys of that is that you really get to see the differences in the way that they think. And that's something, again, that I think you really need a book to do. You need writing to be able to understand thought.
Yeah, I was, when I read that, I was like, wow, that's really interesting. Because, even when you write like a letter to somebody, the way you express yourself is so different to speaking. But I hadn't really just thought about it like that, but there is some sort of filter going on when we speak, I suppose, that, that we can think so much more than we can put into words. But with writing, you have that sort of extra time, I guess, to perhaps more fully express what is going on inside one's mind.
Absolutely.
I wanted to ask you, you recently spent time at the U-Cross Artists Colony in Wyoming, and yeah. Artists Colony has a great ring to it. What exactly does that entail?
It was wonderful. I in my first novel, actually, there's a scene where one of the chapters that the novelist goes to a writer's colony, and I'd never actually been to one when I wrote that chapter, and then I got the opportunity finally to go this past summer, and it was such a wonderful experience. I mentioned earlier my son Joshua was born just after my first book was published, about a month later, and so of course, you know, it became a huge part of my life, you know, changed very drastically. You know, one of the hard things, you know, before I used to have, usually a couple of days every week where I could really sit down and dedicate my time to writing. But then I was really kind of looking to find that again. So I took about 2 weeks at the end of the summer last year, and I went out to Wyoming and just to, you know, have a change of scenery for one thing. You know, I've never been to Wyoming before. I've never seen any place like that. It's so beautiful. U-Cross is a little town in Wyoming that has a population of 25.
Oh my goodness!
There's a little sign, you know, right by the colony when you come in. I think most of those people work at the colony. There's, you know, one or two ranchers, I think, in the area near there. So, I mean, there are more than 25 people on my floor in the apartment building where I live right now.
Right.
So that was just a huge change. And then I was there with, you know, some just truly fantastic other writers and artists. And that was such a rare chance to kind of meet people, you know, in my field. And then also, people, creative people who are kind of, you know, coming at it from a different angle.
Yeah. So Colony, it just means that everyone there is artists, and it's kind of like a retreat. Is that what it means?
Yeah, it's exactly like a retreat. We, you know, you go for, you know, a few weeks. I think most people go for 4 or 6 weeks. And you, they give you a little space to write. I had a room in a little cabin where every day I would kind of get up and jump on a bike and take a little, you know, take a little ride, 5 to 10 minute bike ride out to this, you know, very isolated area, do my writing all day. And then at the end of the day, you get to come back and have dinner with everyone and, you know, sort of share war stories about, you know, what you're working on and all that. It was just wonderful. And I started working on a new book actually while I was there this summer that I don't think I would have ever gotten off the ground if I hadn't been there. So
yeah. How long does it take you to write a book, or does it change? Did it take you a lot longer to write the first one than the second?
No, the first one came together sort of quickly. I wrote my first novel, most of it came together over the course of about a year in 2009. And partly that was because I had, after my sister passed away in 2008, I really hadn't done a lot of writing for the rest of that year. I was still sort of kind of finding my way back. And so when 2009, I sort of made this sort of big commitment that I was going to try to write 40 new stories in a year. And I worked just constantly that whole year. I ended up writing hundreds of pages. Several of those pieces came together into what turned into my first novel. So most of it was, the bulk of it was written in a year. And then you know, some other pieces of it came together in the following year. Why we came to the city, my second novel, like I mentioned before, some pieces of it did start actually coming out in that first year, but it took a while longer than it took, I think, almost close to about 5 years before it was really finished. And it's a bigger book, and there are five characters, so there was a lot more to juggle in terms of that, different perspectives to get into. And there was a lot of it that I wasn't really sure about, like we talked about before. You know, a big part of the book and is understanding grief and sort of how to find your way through that. And to be honest, when I started writing the book, I did not really know. You know, I sort of hoped that I would figure it out along the way. But when I started writing the book in 2009, I was, you know, still very, you know, sort of deeply grieving my sister's death. And then, you know, sort of had some faith, you know, maybe that through writing this, I would sort of find the answers I was looking for.
So, So I was thinking when I was reading the book that I could understand why you would want to write it, because of what you're saying of finding answers. Is part of your hope that people reading it may, not that you're giving them answers, but it may help them to come to some sort of answers for themselves about these difficult kind of experiences?
Yeah, that's it exactly. I wanted, basically what I always tell my students too is, you know, you want to write the book that you wish you could find in the world, but you haven't been able to yet. And this book was, you know, what I thought about a lot was, you know, what is it that I wish I could have read while this was all going on that would have, you know, that would have said, you know, to me, you know, not here's the one path to get, you know, back sort of, you know, into your life again, but rather that would have sort of shown, you know, okay, this is the shape of the struggle that you're facing, and here are some ways of getting through it, and some different ideas, you know. And that was something that you know, and even just to kind of to see that experience you know, sort of mirrored. One thing that I wrote about a little bit recently was the way that, you know, I found myself constantly sort of thrown as my sister was, you know, sort of staying with us and getting her treatments and things, that, you know, it was sort of like it became one more thing that you just had to deal with every day. You know, it was like, you know, going to the grocery store, or doing your laundry. It became sort of, you know, mixed in with all these different routines and everything else, you know, that you have in your life. And that seemed very strange to me. And I realized, you know, in every book and movie that I've ever seen about cancer, you know, you see someone, you know, sort of, you know, quietly convalescing in a hospital somewhere. And, you know, they don't, you know, it seems like their lives have been sort of temporarily suspended as everything's going on. And that was just completely the opposite of reality. It was as if, you know, all the normal parts of your life continue, you know, needing you. And then on top of that, there's something else that, you know, that is very important, you know, trying to fight through. And, you know, so this book tries to sort of show what that looks like in a really honest way. And again, you know, kind of, I think, in a way that, you know, that I hadn't seen really out there before, you know, where the illness becomes, you know, it's central to the story, but it's also just one part of everyone's story in the book.
Yes, yeah. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show, Christopher. And I wanted to tell people they can also go to your website, christopherjansma.com, and that's KristopherJansma, hopefully I said that right, .com.
You got it.
Yeah. And if you're local, Christopher will be at Bookshop Santa Cruz 24th of February at 7 p.m, but he's also on a nationwide book tour, so you could check in on his website and find out if he might be coming near your city. So just thanks so much, Christopher, and I wish you all the best with this book. It's a very enjoyable, well, I say enjoyable read, that sounds it's a very meaningful read and very well written. So yes, I
Thank
encourage
so
people to take a look at it, and I will be at Bookshop Santa Cruz, so I hope to see you there.
I look forward to meeting you there, and
yes,
thanks so much for having me on your show. It's a real pleasure.
You're very welcome. So just to let you know again, that's 24th of February, 7 p.m, Bookshop Santa Cruz. Christopher will be talking about Why We Came to the City, which is his new great book. And just to remind you again about our website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. I encourage you to go there to hear our previous podcasts of all the past shows. Had some great stimulating topics and some wonderful arts guests. And do connect with me on social media too if you wish. So that's itsaquestionofbalance.com. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.